Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3046, United States of America versus Kilo L. King, appellant. Ms. Dyer for the appellant, Ms. Trostman for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Kilo King, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. King appeals whether Booker should be retroactively applied to cases on collateral review because it is substantive. In this case, Mr. King did face a punishment, a mandatory sentence of 120 months, that after Booker, the law cannot impose upon him under the parsimony principle. According to the government, there is no sentence to which the appellant was subject before Booker that is now unavailable to the sentencing court. But Mr. King was subject to a single sentence before Booker, 120 months. That single sentence is not available to the sentencing court. Instead, the court must have applied after Booker the single sentence that meets the parsimony principle. In that case, the government will be required to prove that no lower sentence met that principle, which it was not required to prove before Booker. At the outset and before continuing, I'd like to address the question that the court raised about mootness. I believe that question was decided by the court in United States versus McCoy, and has been decided by at least 7 or 8 other circuits. Those are listed in Mitchell v. Middlebrooks, which is an unpublished case from the 11th Circuit from 2008. At 287 F Appendix 772, 775. In addition, the Third Circuit in Cotman at 142 F 3rd 160 has decided that issue. Because the district court could reduce the supervised release on remand of this case for resentencing, the question of his sentence is not moot, in my view. Booker allows for the development of a kind of a common law of sentencing that was envisioned by Justice Breyer through the appellate review for substantive reasonableness. There are two circuit decisions from the Third and the Ninth Circuit finding guideline sentences to be substantively unreasonable. The first was mentioned in our reply, Olhofsky. That's at 562 F 3rd 530 550 from the Third Circuit. That was a case involving child pornography owned by a socially immature 18-year-old. And in that case, a 6-month sentence was deemed too high, where the guideline range was 135 to 168 months. And in Amezcua Vasquez.
What you're saying is relevant only if Booker's retroactive, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that they provide examples of a sentence that before Booker would have been mandatory under the guidelines and after Booker would have been illegal under 3553A. So that in the Third Circuit at this point, there is a set of sentences involving similar fact patterns of a socially immature defendant in which a post-Booker sentence is now illegal. It's an unconstitutional sentence.
This is an element of your argument that Booker is not retroactive.
It's an element of my argument that Booker is retroactive.
I'm sorry, it's retroactive. But here's my question. Insofar as that's what you're arguing, and that seems to be the major point you're making in the brief, I mean, obviously retroactivity isn't enough, but you need to make this another point. The court decided this in Fashina.
Whether the court decided this in Fashina, I believe, depends on whether this court defines the term issue as it was used in cases such as LaShawn v. Berry as both an argument and the result, or merely the result of a case.
So when we said in Fashina that Booker is not to be applied retroactively, there's room to apply it retroactively?
I believe that decision was made based on a certain claim, a certain argument, and that a different argument could lead to a different result.
So counsel failed to make an argument in that case that you are making here.
That's correct.
And where do we have cases in which one panel of this court has said that a previous panel's decision is limited and can be disregarded because or overtaken by an argument that wasn't presented in the first case?
I don't have an affirmative case to cite.
I think there's a reason for that.
That's possible. I believe the Supreme Court would view an issue not to be precluded by its precedent if the new argument led to a different result.
Well, they don't sit in panels.
That's exactly.
And so they don't have the rule true. That our panels are bound by circuit precedent.
I understand that. And if this court believes that it is bound by Fashina, the court could seek an Irons v. Diamond footnote in order to issue a ruling. And second, we would like to preserve the right to bring this issue before the full court.
And I believe 10 or 11 circuits have held that Booker is not retroactive.
That's correct. I believe all of them have.
And was your argument presented in any of them?
I have not seen it in any published opinion, so I do not know whether it might have been presented and not ruled upon, but I have certainly not seen evidence of consideration of it in any of the opinions that I have read. So I don't know that it has been ruled on by any court. I think that there are three reasons why...
The issue, though, in Fashina was decided. It's not like a situation... You mentioned LaShawn, and we dealt with that in the in-bank LaShawn case. But it's not analogous. Your situation is not analogous to a Pennhurst-type case in which the Supreme Court or any court goes ahead and decides the merits without considering jurisdiction, and then later holds that that is not to be considered stare decisis as far as the jurisdictional question because it was never addressed. Here the question of Booker's retroactivity was addressed specifically, and all you're offering is that, well, I have better arguments for arguments that may not have been raised before.
This court decided that Booker was procedural and not substantive, based on an argument that the Booker decision made sentencing factors now elements of the offense by requiring jury findings on those elements. And this court commented that was precisely the opposite of what Booker had held, that because of the remedy that Booker imposed. I agree that the result in Fashina is the same result that we are asking the court to rule differently on. But we are making an argument, for example, if we were making a Fifth Amendment argument versus Sixth Amendment argument to lead to the same result, I have looked for and have not been able to find authority to suggest that the panel does have the authority to reverse on that basis on a new argument. But there certainly are citations.
Well, the problem you have is that we're bound, it's not just stare decisis, it's by legislation, because in the judicial code it says that the decision of a division, which is a panel, is the way they use it, but is the decision of the court. Mm-hmm. So one panel therefore can't overrule another except in bank.
As I read the cases, they often talk about a decision being a claim, and a claim would constitute an argument leading to a result. And my position is we're making a different claim. If this panel does not view itself as having the authority to come to a different result based on different arguments, then we would seek the review of the full court on the issue.
And you don't need our permission to do that?
No, but I typically would start with the panel. And this court has exercised the Irons v. Diamond footnote option in the past. I see that I am out of time. I may save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless the court has further questions. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Elizabeth Trostman for the government. At the outset, I'd like to address the mootness point, Your Honors. We do believe this case is moot. because of the defendant's release from custody. We'd like to call the court's attention to two circuit cases which we think supports that view. One is Berkey versus Marbury, 556 F3rd 142, Third Circuit case, 2009. The other is U.S. versus Blackburn, 461 F3rd 259, Second Circuit, 2006. Those cases rest on Spencer versus Kemna, where the Supreme Court made clear that a case is moot unless a litigant suffers an injury which is likely to be redressed by a favorable judicial decision, not merely possible, but likely. Appellant here does not allege any defect in his conviction, just in his sentence. He's now been released. He is on supervisory release, but the Supreme Court in the Johnson case made very clear that incarceration and supervised release are very different, that one doesn't substitute for the other, and that even if the defendant were incarcerated, had been incarcerated for too long, his supervised release term couldn't be reduced to remedy that violation. The court in Johnson also made clear that district.
But if he'd served time that he otherwise shouldn't have served, then he can. And we so held, then it would be open to him to file a motion to modify the terms of his supervised release. He's not on a mandatory minimum,
that's
right?
That's true.
So why isn't that sufficient to overcome any mootness objection?
And to be clear, Your Honor, a number of circuits have followed that line of reasoning.
That's right. Only one that deviates is the Third, which you mentioned, because the Third says it has to be likely.
And the second, this Blackburn case is very supportive of our view as well.
Says that too?
Yes. And the reason
the question of reduction of the term, or maybe lessening of the terms of supervised release, or reducing it from 3 years to 2 years, is within the discretion of a district judge. How does a court of appeals make a judgment about whether it's likely that a district judge would do
well,
that?
Well, both of those circuit cases recognize that it's a very fact-bound inquiry, and they actually analyze the facts in those cases to come to the conclusion that a reduction in supervised release would be extremely unlikely. And we can do the same in this case. I think the most telling fact in this case is that the district court had an option there was a maximum statutory 3-year term of supervised release. The district court had an option under the sentencing guidelines of 2 or 3 years, and he chose 3.
Right.
There was no discussion of supervised release at sentencing. The defendant did not ask the district court to go less than 3. Indeed, even in the defendant's 2255 petition, there's no mention of supervised release at all. His 2255 petition only asks for a reduction of his term.
Well, one step at a time.
One step at a time, true. But the other facts...
He hasn't waived a motion to reduce simply because it's not in his habeas corpus petition.
We're not arguing that, but we are stressing it as a factor that goes to the unlikelihood that there would be a reduction. If I could just call the court's attention briefly to the other compelling facts in this record. This defendant had a very long record. He'd been arrested, the court commented, every year since he was 17, and he was, I believe, 30 when he was sentenced. He had a conviction record extremely long. He had a criminal history category of 6. Even after adjustments as a result of his challenges to the PSR, it was still category 6. The theme of the sentencing was that the defendant was in need of rehabilitation. He said on page 10 of the sentencing transcript, I want to change my life. The court agreed on page 11 and talked about how much the prison system had to offer him in the way of counseling, training, education, and said, I hope when you do get out, you'll make a new life for yourself. The Johnson case talked about the rehabilitative purposes of supervised release and how important supervised release is as a bridge between incarceration and the community. So given the defendant's record, the fact that the court chose the maximum supervised release term, the fact that he never asked for less, the fact that everyone agreed that rehabilitation was extremely important. We believe the record shows that it's extremely unlikely that there would be a reduction. Now, if the standard were possibility, perhaps it is possible in this case, would not be moot. But we do think that the Supreme Court has made likelihood the standard. We think those two circuit cases, which we've cited to the court, rely on that standard properly and also make the point that the other circuits have not recognized that likelihood is the standard as opposed to possibility. And we don't believe that this
court... There's a whole line of mootness cases from the Supreme Court that... that doesn't turn on the likelihood of an event, but only the possibility. And that the whole line is the capable of repetition yet evading review line. And in those cases, the court simply talks about whether the issue could arise again. There's no assessment whatsoever about whether it's likely to arise, and particularly likely to arise in the near term.
I guess I think of the capable of repetition yet evading review as an exception to mootness, Your Honor, that first we have to decide, is the case moot or is it not? That standard uses the likelihood standard as opposed to the possibility standard, and only if there's no other way of getting...
Well, it still has to meet Article 3. It's a case or controversy if it's... capable of repetition.
But even the capable of repetition yet evading review... standard talks about the likelihood that that particular defendant would come back before the court. So I think there may be a likelihood standard there as well, but I'm not certain. Mm. If the case is not moot, we would rely... the only other point I wanted to make is we don't believe this court's opinion in McCoy forecloses the result that we're asking for. We think that what the court was saying there is that it was likely enough that the supervised release issue would come up again. The defendant McCoy was alleging a guidelines error, and the court said the court's determination of the length of the supervised release term depended in part on the guideline calculation, and thus, quote, resentencing under a revised computation clearly could benefit McCoy.
Was McCoy on supervised release?
Yes, there was a mootness issue in McCoy. He had been released from incarceration. By the time the case came up before the in-bank court, he'd been released from incarceration, but he was still on supervised release. Mm-hmm. And the court held that the case was not moot because if there were a revised guideline calculation, that could affect the supervised release term. But we think what the court was saying is there was enough of a likelihood in that case. And, of course, we don't think that's the case here, and there was no allegation of a guideline error at all. Just a Booker error, a guideline calculation error, I should say. On the merits, we do rely on Fashina. Fashina held very clearly the government need not prove anything after Booker that it did not need to prove before. Therefore, Booker does not alter the range of conduct the law punishes and is not a substantive rule for retroactivity purposes. We think that forecloses appellant's claim. We believe that appellant brings new theories in support of its claim to the court today. But the claim is essentially the same, which is that Booker is a substantive rule and therefore need not be, therefore should be applied retroactively, and we think that is foreclosed. And if there were any question about whether Fashina governed this case, we believe that Summerlin clearly does, as all of the circuits have held. Summerlin held that Booker is not a substantive rule because it reallocates decision-making authority, and we think Booker does the same.
What do you make of the certificate of appealability? It seems like the trial judge said the only question he was certifying was whether the retroactivity of Booker had been considered on the issue of the court having severed and excised the two sentencing.
We paused over that language as well, Your Honor. Because of the phrasing of that sentence, we weren't sure whether the certificate of appealability was limited to the question of statutory versus constitutional or whether it was broader. I saw that we had conceded the issue at the trial level, and so I did not press the issue here. But, of course, the court would be free to rule that the certificate of appealability was more limited than the briefing indicates.
I mean, this postdated Fischina, right?
Yes.
So he knew
Fischina? Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would point out that Summerlin is not controlling here. In addition to the difference between the reasonable doubt standard there the court said that the case was procedural because it merely moved a decision from the sentencing judge to the jury, and it was the exact same decision being made. The government made the argument in its brief that what Booker did was move the decision from the sentencing commission to the sentencing court. That's not what Booker did. What Booker did was change the decision from a mandatory guidelines to essentially a mandatory 3553A, a completely different sentencing statute, which incorporates consideration of the guidelines but has different priorities. So I think that Summerlin does not control this case. I would reiterate or point out that we believe that Booker is substantive even under the first exception to Teague. Whether or not that first exception covers all substantive rules, or whether there are additional substantive rules that don't meet the first exception, which we tried to outline in my reply. First, because 3553A requires the district court to apply a single sentence that meets the parsimony clause, it is a different sentence. Also, because of substantive reasonableness review, which we have outlined in the briefs, and also because of the mandatory discretionary distinction in Lindsay and the comparison with ex post facto cases.
Thank you for the court's question. What is your reading of the certificate of appealability?
I believe because the court said, among other reasons, that this court should interpret that certificate broadly and include all of the substantive claims that we made that have not been addressed by other circuit courts or were not explicitly addressed in Fischina.
Okay, and the other thing is, what about McCoy's, the difference in McCoy that he was asking for a resentencing that could have affected his supervised release?
Well, we're asking for the same thing, for a resentencing that could affect our supervised release. There, the district court, this court in McCoy said, as the government cited, resentencing under a revised guidelines computation, here it would be a revised sentence of imprisonment and supervised release under Booker, could clearly benefit McCoy. And the same is true of Mr. King. I don't think there's any difference in the argument the presentation, just because McCoy involved a calculation of a specific guideline, and we are asking for resentencing under Booker for a lower sentence, that resentencing would normally include, we would normally, if we were allowed to be resentenced under Booker, would normally include both consideration of the prison term and supervised release, so that any statutory term of supervised release would be authorized, and we would argue that the district court could clearly reduce supervised release if the case were before it again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dyer. Mr. Trostman, thank you. Case is submitted.